Can I just very briefly thank all three for their very thoughtful contributions. I'd like to open it to the floor. Just a couple of very, very quick ground rules. I know a lot of us know each other, but if you could identify yourself, that would be really useful. And the second ground rule, if there are any really, really difficult questions about the research, Tom Hennessy is going to answer them. Yeah, at the back.
Hi, my name is Colin Dorff, and I wrote a piece last week for Young Valley's website about unionism and modernity. And two things that arise out of it, I was just wondering what your thoughts were. The first one is, what do you think of the idea that insofar as unionism was inclusive, that was Carsonite unionism, which deals with Carson, as he said himself in his speech in the House of Lords, because it was Creed unionism that won, and not Carson's vision. And that's my first question. My second question is, should I restate that? Can you?
Everyone here?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Cool. Okay. Second question is, I was wondering, would the panel give their opinion on what they think the moral basis is for the First Minister not to shake hands with the Deputy First Minister, given that he was photographed last year in Parliament buildings shaking hands with Jackie McDonald of the South Belfast UDA leadership? And the reason I think that second question is important is because the former phrase from economics, I believe that there is a trickle-down effect, because I believe that that mindset was enacted by those who attacked the mayor at Greenfield Park. So the first question, just to reiterate very quickly, is do you think that inclusive unionism died with Carson's vision? And the second question is, what moral basis do you think there is to refuse to shake the hands of the Deputy First Minister, your partner in government, his part of government, when he was able to be photographed shaking hands with the UDA leader in South Africa?
Thank you, thank you. A volunteer. Leo,
pluralist unionism is very hard to achieve. I mean, we've seen many occasions in which Peter Robinson and other unionist leaders have made appeals to Catholic voters, saying we're centre-right or we're progressive, we're this, that and the other. But people don't vote. People don't vote across the divides. Catholics don't self-identify as unionists. They don't like the flag-waving aspects and so on, even if they're perhaps telling opinion pollsters that they're willing to vote to remain in the UK. We saw this in this book. 0.6% of the UP members were Catholics after all the talk about it. And it's very hard to extend the unionist brand, because once you do, you become vulnerable to the right. So, I don't know, perhaps that raises a long-term question about whether unionism and nationalism are really going to be the permanent political shape of Northern Ireland. Perhaps something else is going to come in, some other form of division, now that the border issue is decided by a referendum. I don't expect that in the next couple of elections, but I think that's really the question that lies behind all this. Is unionism a valid long-term project? Has it achieved its mission? Has unionism's mission been achieved by setting up the state of Northern Ireland and setting up a state which most people are prepared to live in, and there's no real threat to its borders? Not shaking hands with Martin McGuinness. As far as I know, Peter Robinson has shaken hands
many
with Martin McGuinness. And I think that started off with a private handshake whenever he stepped aside temporarily as leader, and then was repeated in public after that. So that's my bit. Do you want to have a go? No.
Just very quickly, I know most of you know I'm very pessimistic on most things, but in terms of this concept of inclusive unionism and inclusive nationalism, they are both nonsense. They cannot exist, because if you are a unionist, your long-term vision, your ambition, your ultimate aim is to protect and promote the constitutional geographical integrity of the United Kingdom. There is no higher purpose than that for you. If you're a nationalist, Republican, whatever you want to describe yourself, your highest ultimate political, geographical, constitutional aim is a united Ireland. So I'm not sure how a unionist makes himself in any way acceptable to a nationalist agenda. or how a nationalist makes themselves in any way acceptable to a unionist agenda. And that may be the ultimate problem with power sharing in Northern Ireland. Because if you don't even agree on something as basic as the name of the country, if you can't, after 16 years of the Good Friday Agreement, actually say the word without, you know, being turned into stone, Northern Ireland, I belong to the Northern Ireland Executive, I'm a minister in the Northern Ireland Executive. If you can't even do something that basic, then you're never going to be able to build, whether you call it reconciliation or reach out or lovey-dovey or Pollyanna progress, it doesn't matter what you choose to call it, it's not going to amount to a hill of beans for unionists and vice versa.
Thanks, Alex.
Just one small point. I always think it's important to remember that the majority of people in Northern Ireland don't identify willingly as either unionist or...
Scratch them hard enough, they will. They will. Scratch them, they will. I've been to those meetings where people say, oh, we're above it. Scratch them.
Are you arguing against Northern Ireland Life and Time Service?
Yes.
44% of those under 45 said they just refused to describe themselves as either nationalist or unionist.
Good. Well, when I see a huge, big Northern Ireland party which says we're neither unionist nor nationalist and it trumps all the other existing parties, I might believe those things.
One in four Catholics describe themselves as Northern Irish in their identity. But
they don't vote for a unionist party.
Use the term. The Northern Ireland Life and Time Survey is absolutely clear on many of the things that you dispute.
Northern Ireland...
You can refuse to accept the evidence of the Northern Ireland Life and Time Survey, just as we could, if we wanted to, refuse to accept the evidence of this survey.
Surely not, John. But the only thing is, if you look at the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey, the SDLP is the most popular political party. So
I rest my case.
You've got to bear that in mind. But I do think, John, that your basic point that people are perhaps identifying less with unionism and nationalism as time goes on, making it less a primary identity because one reason being the border isn't in doubt now, I think that is probably going to be a trend in the future, but it seems to be a slow burner.
I kind of tried to predict what the points of difference might be this evening. One of the ones I didn't predict was whether sociological surveys are valid or not. Is it Carmel?
Hi, I'm Carmel Ralston. I teach politics at the University of Ulster. I'm sorry, I'm going to bring this back from interesting to essential nerddom. I would like to know whether anybody thinks that there's any prospect of a different electoral system in Northern Ireland, since we're all talking about patterns of voting and who will win what seats. I don't think the single transferable vote that we're very wedded to in Northern Ireland produces a very representative outcome, and I wonder whether some kind of reconfiguration, I've tried to reconcile all the different arguing opinions here, that the reconfiguration that some of us are looking for might be achieved with a different electoral system. But would any of the major parties stand for it at this stage is the sub-question.
Thanks, Carmel.
I haven't much to say in this, but I haven't, to be honest, Carmel, I haven't heard anybody agitating for the end of STV. It seems to be popular on all sides, so I'm not sure if it'll be a good thing or not, but I don't see any demand for it. Nationalists seem to like it because it exists in the south and it ensures proportionality, and unionists seem to like it too, perhaps some of them will tell me they don't.
In the absence of any senior management from the University of Ulster, I'm going to cite Sydney Elliott from Queen's University, not retired, so it's probably safe.
Sydney Elliott's very detailed studies of electoral behaviour and analysis of voting behaviour tended to indicate that, for example, the SDLP was not well served by the single transferable vote system, but they were, as you rightly say, ideologically wedded to it.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
I'm surprised to hear the SDLP is not well served since the NI Life and Time Survey says it's the most popular party in Northern Ireland. But on another issue entirely, no, we did away with first past the post, which I had no difficulty with, on the argument being that the wolves would lie down to the land and they'll be frolicking happily ever. What we did, we created small parties, each from both sides. To be honest, unless you solve the ultimate problem, which is identity in Northern Ireland, doesn't matter what form of election you come up with, because people, when it's back to the scraps of the surface, they will still go back to that moment where they feel most comfortable. The moral high ground is a wonderful place to be. It's a lovely place to be, but you don't win any battles up there.
Don't have to say
anything. Well, the only thing I would mention would be the opportunity for deliberative democracy in the civic forum, and that seems a ripe opportunity for getting a fair representation of alternative voices in Northern Ireland.
Thank you. Please. You might need a microphone and the acoustics in here, aren't you?
I might. My name's Michael Strain. I've lived here for 30 years and I was very interested to see the book come out. And I'm surprised a little disappointed that so much of the discussion has not been about the book, but about the things that you hear talked about on radio and television I don't watch it every day, but frequently during the week. The book, it seems to me, is a very important contribution to Northern Ireland's understanding. Northern Ireland's understanding of itself as a society. For instance, in Chapter 5, it says some important things about the sense of identity being cultivated within and by the DUP, which is a kind of Britishness that is hard to recognise in the mainland of Britain, and even more hard to recognise in England, which is often confused with Britain as being the residual and repository of Britishness. Now, what are the implications of this chapter, Chapter 5? Because we have two political parties seemingly in control of a small, divided community, one of which wants an antiquated version of Britishness, and the other wants a much older version of Irishness. Now, surely this is the challenge that the book has presented to Northern Ireland, and I'm surprised that the more knowledgeable people here tonight haven't wanted to discuss those kinds of questions.
Thank you for that question, Michael. As the author of Chapter 5, I think I want to hear other people might want to say about it.
I
think the point is quite important. That was one of the points that I was going to. I mean, as a Belfast man who's lived in England now for 30 years and done the reverse to yourself, I mean, unfortunately, that there is a visible affiliation with groups like the English Defence League, that's what people, when they see flag waving by many of the unions committee in Northern Ireland, automatically assume is their politics. I mean, by and large, the attitude to Northern Ireland and England that I come across is one where the problem was solved 15 years ago, and it's really not one that impinges. You know, the taxi driver conversation is, yeah, aren't you guys all getting on well nowadays? And the interest level of knowledge is not. It's certainly a one-sided love affair in many cases, and that's what I was trying to bring out in that chapter. Although I think it's also important to state, you know, the intensity of the feeling of affiliation and recognition of Britishness, albeit a different form of Britishness, that the DUP member. Have. I mean, it's fairly uncontested as a first point of identity still, but there is that difference between the rest of the UK in terms of reciprocation.
Yeah, I would echo some of what Jim's points. I'm obviously not in Britain as often as him, But it does seem to me, when I talk to people from over there, other journalists and so on, that there isn't an identification with Northern Ireland. There was a stronger identification with unionism, somewhat stronger anyway, during the Troubles, when this kind of siege mentality and defending the border and flag waving and so on was seen as responding to a genuine threat, that the whole thing was up for grabs. So there was, particularly in the Tory party, a lot more sympathy then. I think now there is a bit of eye rolling, and is that still going on? I remember when Richard Haass came over, he said that when he told his friends in America that he was coming to Northern Ireland to try to deal with some problems about flags and parading and so on, most people said to him, "We thought that was sorted." And I think that is the attitude also in Britain, that people think we're going on a little bit about it. Do we still need to base our politics around this? Do we still need to rise over parades every year? I think we are losing interest, and that's probably a dangerous thing for unionism, mm-hmm. more dangerous for unionism than it is for nationalism.
I would agree with that. I think this thing about Britishness identity, I mean, it is true that in Northern Ireland, where you have a battle where the political war with the whole, the fixed point of political debate is about identity, who you are, what you want to be. I think in cases like that, both sides will almost instinctively go to the easiest, most recognisable base. That's the nature of politics. If you talk about identity, look at Scotland. Look at the debate they're having there about Scottish identity, whether Scotland should be part of the United Kingdom or whether it should be a freestanding nation. You listen to some of the stuff that Scottish nationalists and Scottish national supporters say about the English and what they have done and the oppression they have visited upon Scotland for hundreds of years. You will see a great battle there. You come to UKIP, there's a huge battle there in terms of identity, British identity, with the connection with the European Union, the connection with the immigrant problem and so on. So this notion that Northern Ireland is the only part of the United Kingdom where identity and who you are and what you believe is we're some sort of relic of an old age. We're not. We may still have huge difficulties, but that battle about who you are, what you believe, your vision for the United Kingdom, what you believe in as the Union, it's an argument which is taking place across the United Kingdom, as was seen in the European election, and will be seen in the referendum in Scotland in September.
I'm not sure it's such an important question, to be honest. I think... obviously, my perspective comes from particularly my engagement with younger people and with students, and Britishness and the construction of Britishness is not one of the most important questions for them in the political, with a small p, choices that they make. And I did find that chapter very interesting, Jim, as for all of them. But particularly interesting, I thought, was the lack of a Northern Irish identity. That was very striking from the book. But more broadly, that would be my small contribution on that topic.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. 1, 2.
Can we do it to Mark?
Okay, 2, 1.
Hello. The book notes that the party, which is grounded in religious principles, has accommodated change and broadened its appeal. I'm just wondering, do the panel think that the DUP have reached their peak in that area? Will they be able in the future to further broaden their appeal? I remember that famous column from Tom Kelly, who said to the DUP when he was speaking at their conference, a Catholic is for every day of the year, not just for party conferences. And I'm just wondering to what extent that may be true.
Thank you, Deirdre.
It's a really good question. I think, again, going on the basis of the book, there's certainly room to broaden the membership of the DUP and its representativeness, even amongst Protestants in Northern Ireland. I would think, again, even going back to that question about Britishness, that there's opportunities to do that in a positive and constructive way that perhaps meets the more urgent political concerns of younger generations in Northern Ireland. So yes, certainly, I don't think it's necessarily peaked.
Liam, I know in your coverage that was the expansion of membership, one of the things that you picked up on directly, so I don't know if you want to comment on it directly at this stage.
Yeah, well, I think there is a danger that the DUP has peaked, but I mean, it's a very high peak. It's not often a party reaches this level. And I tried to make in my earlier comments the fact that there's a hardcore of DUP activists whose influence is diminishing slightly over the years as the party grows, as they get an influx of, the factors or whatever you want to call it from the UUP and as younger people join. But it's still very recognisably the same party that it was to begin with. And I just don't know. I think there is a doubt about how far you can stretch that brand. It's certainly something that would require a lot of skill to stretch it. And if you do stretch it and try to start attracting new people, then you risk losing the hardcore, the old stalwarts, the people who've always been with you. So I think that's a problem of growth. I'm not sure if it can be overcome, but it is a problem that you only get when you've reached a very high peak.
I think Liam is right in that one. In terms of peak, you could argue that in May 2011, when the Democratic Unionist Party, I think I wrote about this quite recently, that the First Minister, in one sense, when he looked at the results, when he looked at the DUP, well, he was master of all, he surveyed the DUP, had more votes than any other, all the Unionist parties put together. It had trumped or triumphed in Westminster, in local government, in the Assembly. It had safely got Diane back in Europe. It was a strong, happy party. It has slipped. I mean, between 2005 and now, there's a slippage around 70,000 vote. People who used to vote DUP don't vote anymore. We don't know why that happened. Maybe they're winnable back. But in terms of if a party has reached its peak, you have to say, where else can it reach? Who can it appeal to? Now, there are three basics here in Northern Ireland. It's the non-voters, which is almost 50%. The problem with the non-voters, I used to be, in the Old Students' Party, I used to have this slight, in the days when I had moments, of very rare moments of optimism, I used to believe that there's a section of the non-voters who are actually middle-of-the-road liberals who wanted everybody to live peacefully. I'm increasingly of the view that they don't exist, that most of the people who don't have a very substantial majority of non-voters are actually probably more belligerent and hard-line than most of us would want to admit. And in terms of this middle ground, which supposedly exists, hasn't come out for Alliance in 40 years. It didn't come out for NI21. Yes, they've had their problems, I accept that. But, I mean, they weren't getting them anyway. There was absolutely no indication whatsoever that NI21, had they not had that, that lovely implosion, just the day people went, 50, 60,000 people went, oh, I better not vote for them. It wasn't happening. So that was, in terms of the DUP, do they reach out to the Ulster Unionists, to the TUV, to the PUP, to the Conservatives? I mean, in reaching out, as David Trimble found, you can bring in 10 people from the UUP, but you can lose 9 from the DUP. So it's a great calculation you have to make, and quite often it's not worth the bother. And in terms of and I know the First Minister has done this, and David Trimble tried as well, this reaching out to the Catholic voter. I mean, the Irish News had an editorial saying a lot of Roman Catholics are happy, and on moral issues they might find themselves more comfortable with the DUP than they are with the SDLP or Sinn Féin. But the reality is, if you are a Roman Catholic, small-end nationalist, who agrees with the DUP on abortion and mixed marriage and things like that, not mixed marriage, well, you know what I mean by mixed marriage, two types there, who agrees with that stance, but you're also a believer in a united Ireland, how many Roman Catholics are going to say, oh yeah, fine, yeah, I'm happy with that stance, and I'll vote for a unionist party which believes in the United Kingdom, even though I believe in the United Ireland. So the reality is, in terms of if they have peaked, I'm not sure how much more digging the DUP can do into those three main voter bases. But in terms of whether they're going to remain as the largest unionist party for the foreseeable future, absolutely no doubt.
Thanks, Alex.
Can I just say...
Your question, yeah?
I think just pick you up on the point about apathy and people not voting, because they're too... I mean, surely there's so many options for people who have hardline views and who would like to vote. I think, to go back to Carmel's point about the political... the electoral system, a big part of apathy is the judgment that people make is that their vote wouldn't make any difference. So I'd be much more of the view that people don't vote because... because they have liberal views or because they simply don't see a political party that represents them or that is likely to make a difference.
Then why not vote for the closest? I mean, I heard this for years, that there are all these liberals hiding there, but they're so liberal they can't somehow bring themselves to vote for the Alliance Party.
I
can understand the argument.
Say, what difference would it make? And a big part of them, people who never even think of themselves or Northern Ireland in political terms, that they could actually make a difference through their vote. So they simply become disengaged as citizens, full stop.
Can I just make, sorry, Jim, can I just make just one very brief point on that? Just one very brief. It's one thing that has struck me about Northern Ireland, and I backed the agreement, but there were huge difficulties with it, but I supported it. One of the things I believed would happen, stupidly as it turns out, but one of the things I believed would happen is that as Northern Ireland entered this new era of political dispensation and how we do business, that there would, in fact, as there had been in 1970, that there would, in fact, be a creation of maybe half a dozen new political parties. None of that has happened. And I think that's probably somebody asked me to pick the oddest thing of all in the past 17 years, and there have been many of them. The oddest would be the fact that we still don't, NI21 doesn't count, that's two people who failed to lead another party, set up their own, but we have never had a genuine, credible, honest-to-goodness post-conflict political party.
Yeah, thank you. We are coming to an end. I will come to you next, but Arlene, are you? Yeah.
Well, I'm going to stand up because I'm comfortable standing up. There's been a lot of chat about the party, so I thought I would speak, and thank you very much to the panel for their thought-provoking talks tonight. And just back to chapter 5, and I'm quoted in chapter 5, and there's a piece in it talking about identity, and I suppose in that I say that there's many layers to identity, on page 119. yet I'm defined as being in the negative, which I found rather disappointing, given that I give a lot of things that I was as opposed to what I wasn't, but there you go. And can I just say to you, in that chapter as well, Peter is referenced as saying the old orange and green British Irish dichotomy no longer adequately sums up the myriad of shades of identity here. Old style unionist majority is a thing of the past. And as someone who represents a constituency in the west of Northern Ireland, I represent a constituency, I'm in the minority, so I very much recognise the Carson agenda, if you like, and he always talked about the fact that those parts of Ireland that he's talking about at that particular point in time must feel the benefit of being part of the Union. And so Fermanagh, Strabane, all of those places must feel the benefit of being part of Northern Ireland. And to your point, sir, about people recognising themselves as Northern Irish now, I think that's a benefit to what we've been able to achieve here over this past number of years, because we have been trying to build a Northern Ireland that is content with itself, a Northern Ireland that wants to move forward. Yes, for us, very fundamentally, it's within the United Kingdom, but we recognise that people have aspirations to something different, but we want them to be content in Northern Ireland and to have a normal life. And Peter said yesterday when we announced the Open coming back to Portrush that it was a normalisation of Northern Ireland, and I fundamentally agree with that. When you see large-scale events coming to Northern Ireland, then we can be very blasé about all of this, but when I look back to when I was a student at Queen's University in Belfast, this place has changed, and changed utterly, to quote somebody who's very close to me in County Fermanagh, and it has changed. And I think that we shouldn't look past the leadership that we've had to make that change in Northern Ireland. And if people recognise themselves as Northern Irish, I think that's a positive thing for me as a unionist, and I hope for everybody in Northern Ireland. And can I say, I'm one of the 18% quoted, and I'll let everybody work out what that means.
Thanks very much, Arlene. I think that the point is trying to be made in that passage, he says. Actually, the notion of people saying being multidimensional and multi-layered is actually a very progressive and very positive one. So, the reason negativity is introduced in that sense is it's trying to introduce the notion of that sometimes unionists and Protestants construct an identity stating as much about what they are not as much as what they are. It's not saying that you're negative. It's about the in the round how identity is is thought of. So sometimes that's done through a positive affiliation with certain things, and sometimes it's done through saying, this is what I am not. But it might just be a very badly written passage. I did that ages ago. The woman with the blonde hair, Sorry? Yeah, there's a microphone coming to you.
Hi, well, my name's Claire Gray and I'm a freelance journalist in Belfast. And I was just going off the back of Alex Kane's point there about the recent council and European elections and the kind of rise of the nationalist vote there. And I suppose maybe Andrew and Liam Clark's observations on the big headlines that have come to the Belfast Telegraph on the back of this study and this research. But where's the nationalist vote going right? Where the DUP vote is going wrong?
Okay, thank you very much. Any of the panel want to comment on either the last two inputs, that would be very welcome.
Well, I think the problem that unionism has with trying to get people are talking about Catholics being content in Northern Ireland is that we have to some extent got a pluralist Northern Ireland, inclusive Northern Ireland, where people feel included, but people don't feel included by the brand of unionism, and I think that's the problem. Catholics, by and large, we all know some exceptions, we all know some people, won't vote for a unionist party, because although they may be happy enough with the union, they're not happy with unionism. They identify it with orange parades, and we see that, you know, the Orange Order has a tremendous influence in the DUP. That's shown in here. They associate it with flag waving. They associate it with perhaps the cultural expressions won't be accepted, and so on. So they end up voting for a nationalist party, I think, and a lot of people wouldn't vote the same way if there was a referendum on the border. So I think that's... That's one reason that the nationalist vote stays quite high, and the unionist vote, well, it's starting to splinter. You're starting to get new parties coming up and so on, and you had you had the PUP, for instance, had a voter registration drive this year, and so did the Ulster Political Research Group, and we're seeing unions vote going up overall, but you're not seeing the dominance of the DUP being reinforced. You're seeing it slipping a little bit, but still remaining the dominant party.
In terms of two things, can I just touch on the point Arlene made about the Northern Irish identity, and she was happy with it, and I think William Humphrey on the same page is happy with it, and I think even Gregory Campbell somewhere along the way, who I discovered was a member of the Young Unionists, which I never knew before, which explains a lot. But in terms, that's fine. It's a good defence of the Northern Irish identity. But on page 118, Nelson McCausland says Northern Irishness was deliberately pushed by the government because the term was that ambiguous. It was generating and creates a middle ground. So I mean, Nelson and some other people in the book did agree with that view. That actually, oddly enough, I don't agree with Nelson's analysis, but I don't like the term. I don't like Northern Irish. It's not to do with the Irish side. I just, part of it just strikes me as a diminution of the bigger pro-union United Kingdom citizenship. When anybody ever asks me what I am, apart from the obvious, I say, I just say I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom. It's that simple. I know it's a bit, no, that's who I am. I don't like all this diminution of it. But in terms of the question about the, what are the DUP, or what's nationalism doing right, unionism's doing wrong, well, there are two things to bear in mind. First thing is that the unionist vote actually increased this time. For the first time in a very long time, it increased, and the overall nationalist Republican vote fell. But the other reason, that if you're picking on the DUP, saying where their slippage comes from the fact that you have, was it the UUP, DUP, PUB, TUV, Conservatives, UKIP, and NI21, or at least those who still identify themselves as unionists. So you have a split, as the First Minister said on many occasions, when you split you know, the pie, whoever isn't has their own pie, is a terrible metaphor. But it benefits, you know, it certainly benefits Sinn Féin and the SDLP when you've only two nationalist Republican parties fighting for the vote. But in terms of unionism, generally, and it's the irony of this, that the more unionist parties you have, the greater the unionist vote seems to be. It doesn't, in fact, help the biggest party, because, again, the other irony of that is that the more unionist people voting for other parties, the more likely it is that the DUP stays number one party, but it loses its position as the party which provides the First Minister.
OK, thank you very much. I was just going to say, that's the end, but how can I? First Minister. Someone gets a microphone to Peter.
I may be able to do without it. First of all, can I thank John and his team for the work that they undertook. It's said that it was a brave thing for a political party to do, to find out what their members thought. That isn't the brave part. The brave part is that everybody else finds out. However, it is, I think, a worthwhile exercise. One of the difficulties, of course, in looking at it is that you see where it is now, but you don't see how it has changed over the years preceding the study. And those of us who have been in the party for a very long period of time will know that the findings demonstrate a very significant change both in the makeup and outlook of the membership of the party, and I'm convinced that that's a trend that will continue. So whether it's 10 or 20 years from now and a similar kind of study is done, I believe that you'll see that progression. In answer to the question of whether there is further room for the Democratic Unionist Party to increase its support, of course there is, and of course you would expect me to say that, but the reality, of course, is this: that it becomes much more difficult to increase support when we have a deeply divided society. The more our society beds down and stability is the more recognised component, I think the more opportunity for the Democratic Unionist Party to increase its support. The division within the community as a whole, I think, encourages fringe groups to go forward. That obviously shreds the overall vote for the main parties. But I think in a stable society, there will be more people, I think, that will be prepared to come out and to vote freely for whatever party. And, you know, whether you're a Protestant or a Catholic, very few people agree 100% with the programme of any political party. They're all people if they do. They determine what is the most important issue for them, and many what is the most important issue for them at that time to determine what way they would vote. So there may well be many Catholics who want a united Ireland will say yes, but that's not something that's on the horizon. What's important for me now is, maybe it's because of the DUP's pro-business stand, or maybe it's because of the views on some of the, what are referred to as moral issues. So they will, if you like, give or lend the party their vote at elections for that purpose. But I mean, I look forward to the day when people will determine whether they vote, not on the basis of how they were brought up religiously, but upon some ideology and view of policy matters. And that only really happens, I think, in a more settled society than at the present time. But I firmly believe that there is further progress that the Democratic Unionist Party can make. I don't see the slip as being of significance. We have, over recent years, done worse at local government and the European election than we have at Westminster and Assembly elections for different reasons. Maybe one of the issues about the electoral system. If it was a first-past-the-post system, you would have very few fringe parties getting support. Indeed, it might be worth pointing out that in terms of electoral system, all of the unionist parties wanted a different electoral system when we had the convention back in the bygone days of yore, and they were seeking to have a modified list system at that time. However, the SDLP was so wedded, probably because the Republic was using the STV system to have that system and it held. But it doesn't really matter what system that you have. At the end of the day, those who have the greatest support come through the system. And, you know, we have a crazy situation at the present time where we have an assembly with 108 members for a country of 1.8 people that were about a million have the right to vote. It should be smaller. If it was smaller, again, some of the fringe parties would fall off the edge in terms of the multi-member constituencies being smaller. So I don't fear for the future in any way, but I do point out, whenever you're determining strategy, you don't determine strategy on the basis of what will get us the most number of votes. And that's largely what the press and the commentators seem to think is in the mind of politicians and political parties. That isn't the basis upon which you determine what it is you feel is the right thing and the best outcome, and you go for it. In many occasions, that has been detrimental to party support. We lost 40% of our vote after we signed up for the St Andrews Agreement. We knew we were going to lose support as a result of that, but we did it anyway because it was the right thing to do. So you don't go out of your way to take policies that are going to lose you support, but you know, if you're only governed by the level of your percentage vote, you're never going to make any progress. And I think if it hadn't been for the Democratic Unionist Party, Northern Ireland would not be as advanced as it is, though it still has a very long way to go.
Thank you very much indeed, and for engaging with the other comments that were made during the evening. Deirdre.
Okay, First Minister, Minister, distinguished guests, as Provost of Communication, it's my pleasure to bring this engaging, thought-provoking, challenging evening to an end, and to thank you all for coming out on this unusually sunny evening in Northern Ireland, and to forgo the football. And I suppose in conclusion, I have to say, we're not Brazil, we're Northern Ireland.